This could be Dr. Nancy Weinfield, who is the Senior Study Director at WESTAT, a contract research organization in Rockville, Maryland. She is a developmental psychologist who specializes in family research and parent-child relationships, and she's been working on the National Children's Study for WESTAT in various capacities since 2007. Dr. Nancy?
Thank you. All right, well, first, a little bit of business. Again, the official disclosures. I have no disclosures to make, so we can move on from that. Okay. In most child and family-focused studies that include fathers, mothers and children are recruited first. Fathers are recruited often at a later point in time, and frequently that makes access to fathers contingent upon mothers' cooperation. And it also relegates fathers to somewhat of a secondary role in the research. Now, fathers, whether this is related to that or just in general, are more difficult to engage, more difficult to track, and more difficult to retain in family and child-focused research. But techniques for recruiting and retaining fathers, although challenging, have been evolving over time. So what I'm going to be talking about today is a literature analysis that examines recruitment and retention in longitudinal studies that included fathers, focusing on pitfalls and pathways to success in recruiting and retaining those fathers. I have several goals in this. For our analysis, one major goal was to identify relevant studies, relevant meaning relevant to NCS and its goals, so studies that would create a good model for NCS to look at. We calculated and examined recruitment and retention rates for fathers in all of the relevant studies. We ranked the studies and their effectiveness in recruitment and retention, and explored practices associated with effectiveness. That was a qualitative exploration. And finally, we hope to use this information to guide formative research and ultimately father recruitment into the NCS main study. So today I'm going to review some of the major quantitative and qualitative findings from this analysis and conclude with some lessons learned and issues to consider in recruitment and retention of fathers. So first, how did we select studies? Well, we selected studies that were either within or outside the U.S. that shared features with the NCS, including mostly large studies exploring health and development of children and their families. We did allow inclusion of some studies that differed from the NCS slightly to allow a little bit of variability and more lessons learned. We collected data from published literature and also from gray literature, that's websites, operations manuals, things of that sort that haven't been peer-reviewed. And because the focus here is operational, that was okay. We abstracted key information about recruitment and retention rates and practices, and verified the information with study investigators whenever possible. And we have 12 studies included in this analysis. So this is a list of the studies included, and you can see that it includes a variety of studies. Some are government-run, some are university-based, some are within the U.S., some are outside the U.S., and they have widely varied target populations of families. So, what did we find? Now, for starters, rather than using the recruitment and retention rates that studies reported themselves in the literature, we abstracted raw numbers from publications and from the gray literature. And that's because we wanted to calculate recruitment and retention rates on our own. If you've ever really looked in depth at this, the recruitment rates and retention rates that studies report, sometimes it's really hard to figure out what did they do in calculating that rate. Because everybody kind of has their own rules about eligibility and exactly what statistic to use and what's your denominator, and we decided let's be consistent so that we can fairly compare across studies. So we calculated two major types of statistics, cooperation rates, which represent the proportion of eligible fathers contacted who then completed the baseline data collection. And we used APOR cooperation rate 2 for that. And we also calculated retention rates, and that represents the proportion of individuals who completed a baseline data collection, fathers in this case, who continued to participate at subsequent data collection points, and we used APOR response rate 6 for that. So based on these quantitative indicators, we also looked at recruitment and retention practices of the most and least effective studies, looking for qualitative patterns. So this table shows baseline cooperation rates for all the studies that had sufficient data to calculate a cooperation rate. We did have one study where we couldn't do that. They didn't track how many people they actually invited to participate. The mean was 69.1%, which is actually pretty good. But you can see that there's a lot of variability. It's all the way from just under 36% to just over 96%. So there's a lot of room for differences in how effective studies were. And what we did is look at those in the upper quartile versus the lower quartile to look at effectiveness. So what are some things that related to effectiveness and cooperation? Well, somewhat dishearteningly, sample and family characteristics seem to be a big driver. Studies in the upper quartile were generally characterized by samples of higher maternal and paternal education levels and middle class incomes, and they all focused solely on residential fathers. Some of them started pursuing non-residential fathers. It proved too difficult to do, and they just gave up. In contrast, the lower quartile studies targeted greater proportions of non-residential fathers, lower income families, and families with more varied education levels. So higher cooperation rates may in part be not due to exactly what you're doing, but who you're targeting in your research. And operationally, that's not very good news, because it doesn't give us a whole lot to work with other than study the easier people. Recruitment approaches, however, did make a difference. So they differed between the quartiles, and all the upper quartile studies made direct contact with the fathers for recruitment. Either by phone or in person, they invited the fathers individually and directly to participate in studies rather than having the mothers ask the fathers if they would participate. Two of the three lower quartile studies didn't contact the fathers directly at all for recruitment. They supplied questionnaires for the fathers, either giving them to the mothers as a leave behind and saying, could you give this to the father and have him return them to us? Or they did it through mail without actually securing participation first. Now, the lack of in-person contact with fathers, including no opportunity to make the fathers feel necessary or valued within the context of the study, may have been a contributing factor for these low cooperation rates. Fathers may have felt their input wasn't really needed. The study was telling them it wasn't really needed. And the lack of personal contact may have really exacerbated that perception. So moving on to retention, we focused on longitudinal retention since the first father data collection. And we calculated retention at three key time points: short term, 1 year after father baseline; mid-range, 3 years after; and longer term, 5 years after. Some of the studies went on much longer than this, but we wanted to try to capture the largest number, and five seemed to be the upper limit of that. So because data collection times varied across studies, and not everyone collected data exactly at these times, what we did is calculate fit lines. And for studies that didn't have data at exactly these time periods, we created estimates of the study's data collection at that time period. They had to have data collection before and after for us to use the fit line, so that it was guaranteed to be a decent fit. So retention was actually quite high, even after 5 years, with the mean just over 87%. That's pretty good. The variability, however, really increased with time. You can see that by 5 years, that standard deviation is pretty darn large. So there are a lot of differences between studies in how they're doing in keeping people in the study. We decided to graph this because nothing shows you patterns quite as well as a graph. And this is what the graph looks like. And this is actual retention, not estimated retention. So one thing to note about this graph, probably one of the first things you'll notice is, hey, wait, there's a line that goes above 100%. What's that about? It's not typically possible in retention statistics, but this is one of those funny things about doing retention with fathers. Because they're secondarily recruited from families that are already participating in a study, you actually get cases where there's no father participating at the father baseline, either because he refused or because there's no eligible father in that household. And yet, by a subsequent data collection, that father either changes his mind, or there's an eligible father who comes into the family and decides to participate. So all of a sudden, you have numbers that that exceed your baseline possible number of fathers. And that's what's going on here, a couple of studies that suddenly go above 100. It was quite a surprise to us at first, too. But when you think it through, because of the secondary recruitment, it makes some sense. All right, so we then divided studies by the slope of the retention line into those with more gentle attrition slopes and those with more steep attrition slopes. To examine qualities of most and least successful retention efforts, slope seemed the best approach to take here because no one snapshot of time quite captures the pattern. And we had 5 gentle attrition studies and 5 steeper attrition studies who basically did a median split on slope. So what are the characteristics of most and least successful retention? Well, residential status of fathers comes up again. Non-residential fathers are a lot more difficult to retain. 4 of the 5 steep attrition studies sought both non-residential and residential fathers, and among the gentle attrition studies, very few had any substantive representation of non-residential fathers. But it's not just the characteristics of the participants. There are also operational issues. In particular, efforts to prevent participant loss differed across the studies. So a certain amount of participant loss is not due to refusals, but difficulty in just finding people. And that was an issue here. Many of the gentle attrition studies use specialized tracing and tracking teams that their sole purpose for existence was to locate these people who the study had lost contact with. And a lot of them went beyond typical additional contact inquiries to use some really creative means to try to find fathers and give them a chance to participate. A lot of them hadn't lost interest, they just lost contact with the study. Steeper attrition studies tended to use only basic techniques, or they didn't have any program at all for tracing and tracking. But locating participants didn't ensure completed interviews. Another important element was having a refusal avoidance program or refusal conversion program. So training interviewers in how to ease off just the right amount and try to re-engage people to ensure that people wouldn't drop out when really you'd just hit them on a bad day. And they were otherwise saying no, but if you were willing to be flexible, if you're willing to listen to some of their issues, if you took the right approach, they would, in fact, complete the data collection. Burden and data collection approach were interesting. So the length of the actual interview, turns out, didn't differentiate the groups. Some had very short interviews, some had very long. It was mixed between most and least effective. Not really meaningful. But the way the interviews were concentrated, that was meaningful. Studies with more frequent data collection had worse retention, even if those data collections were short. So among the gentle attrition studies, their contacts were about 1 to 2 years apart. Among the steeper attrition studies, they tend to be 1 year or less. Some studies had very concentrated data collections, and even if it was only a few minutes each time, it seemed to aggravate this perception that the study was asking a lot of the father participants. The gentle attrition studies also all made personal contact with the fathers to collect data after baseline. Again, the personal contact issue comes into play. The steep attrition studies were more likely to rely on mail or leave behind consistently. And in fact, one of the steep attrition studies never, throughout the course of the study, made direct contact with the fathers. Now, incentives are the final issue, and cash incentives were more likely to be offered to fathers in the gentle attrition studies. In the steep attrition studies, they tended not to. And this is strangely pretty common. A lot of studies offer an incentive to the mother that covers the whole family. They don't offer cash incentives or any incentives to the fathers. And in some cases, while even the incentive amount itself may be nominal, just making that offer may be important. Okay. So Westat is currently conducting some formative research to follow up on some of these issues. We're doing qualitative in-depth interviews, and we're going to be doing focus groups with both mothers and fathers who are expecting or who have young children to get further clarification on some of these issues. Topics we're covering include things like, what do these parents perceive as some of the barriers to participation among non-residential fathers? And how and why do mothers decide to allow or not allow the studies to contact children's fathers? If you're invited to have the study contact your father, what makes you say no? And given that so many children have multiple father figures, and this is one that's intriguing to me in particular, how do mothers make the decision about who to identify as the father or father figure when asked? Do they default to the father who they believe is the best influence on the child? Or perhaps the father who has the best relationship with the mother? And does the way the questions ask result in a different man being identified if there are multiple fathers to choose from? And how does that affect what you find in your data analysis? So from this examination of other studies' successes and difficulties, several topics have also emerged as issues to consider in recruiting and retaining fathers. One that's come up over and over, direct contact with father respondents seems to be really important, both for recruitment and retention. Phone or in-person contact is harder to dismiss than a leave-behind questionnaire, something that comes through the mail. But it also lets fathers know that they're valued, that their participation means something to the study, the study's reaching out to them, not just sending them a piece of paper. One of the things that shocked me in doing this is that the identity of the father respondent can actually change over time. A family can have perfect father retention, and yet that father can have a different identity at every data collection point. It's allowed to vary. So through divorce, cohabitation, marriage, remarriage, the actual father figure can change throughout the study. And that can pose analytical challenges because you have different people answering your questionnaires, and if you're looking at continuity, it's continuity of what? It's not intra-individual. But it also means something for recruitment and retention because you have to be both in recruitment mode and retention mode all the time. The person you're sitting in front of to collect data may be new to the study, in which case you're recruiting. The person may have a long history with the study, in which case you're retaining. And those are different activities. The data collectors need to know which one they're doing at any given time point. And you need to start building trust all over again if the father respondent changes. And you need to make decisions, if there are multiple father figures, about who do you follow. Do you allow the father respondent identity to change? Or do you continue to follow the person you started with? And a lot of that is driven by operational issues. Non-residential dads are difficult to recruit, but they're difficult to retain, too. And so if you stick with whoever is in the household, it's probably easier, but it may not fit your study well. And so it depends on what types of exposures you're interested in, what types of experiences you're interested in. Does that apply to the father in the household, or does that apply to a particular figure in the child's life? And so studies should be looking really carefully at what type of data are required before they make decisions about which father to follow. It seems like fairly often studies are making that decision based on operational issues. And finally, there are some really creative retention strategies going on out there. It used to be that to retain people, you asked for a couple of contacts, additional things, you know, someone who would always know where you are and get a phone number. And that was the extent to which people really put an effort into tracing and tracking. But with new media, social media, texting, things like that, there's so many more avenues opening up to reach out to parents and to reach out to fathers in particular who may not be the ones answering the landline at home, if the family even has a landline anymore. Cell phone numbers change, Facebook pages don't, or at least not as often. And so there are a lot of new avenues for trying to keep in touch with fathers, and studies are really just starting to explore these, but it seems like for the few that were going after these newer strategies, it was really working for them. So it's something to explore for the future as people don't have mail and landlines as their major mode of communication. We shouldn't be trying to communicate with them through those modes either. Thank you.